This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, Case 2, Bodhidharma's Emptiness. A pointer. This person presented a jewel three times, but didn't escape punishment. When a luminous jewel is thrown to anyone, few do not draw their sword. For an impromptu guest, there is no impromptu host. What's appropriate provisionally is not appropriate for the real. If unusual treasures and rare jewels cannot be put to use, I'll bring out the head of a dead cat. Look. The main case. Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great teacher, Bodhidharma, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? Bodhidharma said, empty, there is no holy. The emperor said, who are you facing me? And Bodhidharma said, don't know. The emperor didn't understand. Bodhidharma subsequently crossed the Yangtze River, came to Shaolin, and faced a wall for 9 years. The verse. Empty, nothing holy. The approach is far off. Succeeding, he swings the axe without injuring the nose. Failing, he drops the pitcher without looking back. Still and silent, coolly, he sat at Shaolin. In silence, he completely brought up the true imperative. The clear moon of autumn turns its frosty disk. The Milky Way thin. The dipper hangs down its handle in the night. In succession, the robe and bowl have been imparted to descendants. From this, humans and divinities have made medicine and disease. We did Bodhidharma Sesshin last week and wasn't quite done with Bodhidharma. This is a very well-known koan, and it's one of the only koans that involves Bodhidharma, who is credited with being the beginning of the Zen tradition in China. Emperor Wu is an historical figure. He became emperor on Buddha's birthday in the year 502 in the Common Era. And there is a fair amount known about him. He was a very devout Buddhist practitioner who kind of modeled himself in his after Ashoka, the great Indian emperor, who, after wreaking havoc across much of India, had a conversion and became a very devout practitioner and supporter of Buddhism. And it's actually through the efforts of Ashoka that much of what has been through his efforts, it's possible in India to verify many of the main sites where the Buddha lived and taught and was active. Emperor Wu, as soon as he became emperor, began to build a lot of monasteries, and he supported the ordaining of monks and nuns. He really wanted to grow the Sangha. He invited a lot of very well-known translators to gather for translation projects within and around the palace. So he was instrumental in helping to generate translations so that the Dharma could prosper. It's said that he took the Bodhisattva vows at least four times, and that after he took them each time, he would go and live in the monastery, which was right next to the palace, and stay there. And so all of the officers, the cabinet of the emperor, eventually would have to come and get him to come back and do his job. And the only way he would come back is if they made lots of donations to the monastery. So, in this koan, in the Bluecliff Record, he first talks about to Bodhidharma all of the efforts that he made, building temples and helping to ordain monastics and translating sutras, which within Buddhism are some of the most powerful things you can do to gain merit and to ensure good karma and a favorable rebirth. And so he asked Bodhidharma what merit had he earned as a result of all of these efforts of his, and Bodhidharma said, no merit whatsoever. And then he went on to ask, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? And the rest of the case as it stands. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up is because sometimes people will ask, why is emptiness important? Why is it important as a teaching? Why is it important to in terms of practice to realize it? Because it is, of course, we might say one of the most inaccessible aspects of the practice, because it is by its very nature not accessible to our senses. You can't touch it. It has no definition, no characteristics. It has no address. You can't get to it. And it also, emptiness is a word, but to understand what does that actually mean in Buddhism is something that we have to develop understanding of, the empty of any inherent essence, any autonomous personhood or characteristics. And so here it's brought right out. What is the highest meaning of the holy truths? The Buddha was very clear throughout his life. At a time when there was a great deal of energy and inquiry and debate and conversation and ideas being formulated about the nature of things, the universe, religiousness, how the world worked together. And the Buddha was very, and the Buddha was born into this time and place, and he was very clear that what he was devoted to in his own search was the cause of human suffering, of dukkha. Why in this world do we struggle so? In a sense, the simplest and the most demanding of questions. And in an effort to, in asking that question, why do we struggle so? Of course, he wanted to be released from that struggle. And so throughout the history of the Dharma, since the Buddha, in a sense, this what we share together as Buddhist practitioners is that every person who's drawn to the Dharma, if they're really drawn to the Dharma, is driven in some way within their own heart to that very question. Why do we struggle so? And the resolution of that question. To not just be alive, but to be alive. To not just have life, but to be free within it. And within this physical body, this mind-body complex, because we are sentient beings, that's the pathway by which we are experiencing everything through sensations of all kinds, feeling sensations and emotions, physical sensations, sensations we associate with our mind, that come with thoughts, that arise out of memories, that come forth with anticipation of things yet to happen. When we touch, or hear, or smell, or taste, we're experiencing sensations. And we experience those in a range of ways, from pleasurable to painful, neutral. And within those words are a vast array of shades and nuance and light and heavy. And all of those experiences seem to stand in front of us immediately. There's an immediacy within those sensations. In a sense, they're because we're sentient beings, we trust those sensations, it seems, above all else. Because it's the experience of it is not something that we're doing, it's not something that we're contriving, it. We're not trying to have that sensory experience, we're not deciding to have that sensation. We're having it. And so it seems to be inherent, it seems to be intrinsic within that moment of contact. And so that sensation seems to stand in front or lay over everything. That's what we take as our direct experience, which is why so much of our effort is to move towards that whole family of sensations which we want to have, and to move away from all of those that we don't want to have. And so we can think of or speak of loneliness or sadness or anxiety, fear, anger, jealousy. And we can experience those lightly, they come and go, or they can consume us. We might experience them for fleeting moments. They might be themes within our lives, kind of defining themes. They can become like a fixed resident within us that seems to be everywhere we go. How do we find liberation? What is liberation? And so Emperor Wu says, what is the highest meaning of the holy truth? We are experiencing something. We call that conventional truth, a conventional truth, a relative truth. Something is happening. We shouldn't deny it. And yet the teachings over and over and over again say that as in the faith mind, to pursue the appearances of things, to rely upon the way something comes to us in that sensation, in that moment of contact, is to miss the source. And so we are experiencing something, but what is it? What is the truth of it? And so for the Buddha, truth, he wasn't interested in metaphysical, cosmological, explaining, all about the universe. He was devoted to what do we need to know? What do we need to examine? What do we need to realize directly in order to free us of that struggle? I was reading a text recently by a scholar, and he talked about the sort of the climate, worldview climate that the Buddha grew up in, and within the development of Brahmanism, and this notion of the Brahman, this all-pervasive, unconditioned force that pervaded everything. And that, as the scholar says, was driven by karmic energies exhibiting causal regularity, that it had to do with explaining. It was that time, those people's way of explaining the relationship between how we understand the world, what we do within it, and what happens. Right? Which is sort of the essential formula that we want to get a handle on. Right? Like, what is this? What am I doing in it? And what happens when I do that thing? Right? Does it bring me what I hope it brings me in my life, or does it not? And the scholar was saying that, was talking about this as he says, a considerable intellectual achievement, or perhaps better, a realization that was only at that time expressible because of more abstract modes of thinking. So it's sort of like the evolution of humanity's ability to think about the world and take up these kinds of questions that was completely linked, intimately linked with language and our ability to conceptualize it through language, right? That they went hand in hand. And he went on to say that, he said, what was lacking in previous eras was a set of commonplace but abstract terms which by their interrelations could describe our physical world conceptually. Right? Because in all of this trying to understand, it's a conceptual understanding. And so he said terms like space and void and matter and elements and motion, change, dimension, these had to sort of be forged, these concepts, to be able to conceptualize, to think about things that we weren't in direct sensory contact with. And he said, aside altogether from the creation of abstract nouns, this conceptual task also required the elimination or the devaluing of verbs of doing and acting and happening. One may even say of living and dying in favor of a syntax which states permanent relationships between conceptual terms systematically. He says, for this purpose, the required linguistic mechanism was furnished by the timeless present of the verb to be. I was, I am, I will be, you are, it is. And to think about that, the power of language, right, which is really inseparable for us from consciousness, from our world. And it's a construction, it's an abstract, we're just making sounds. And into those sounds we infuse meaning. And all of that comes from consciousness and then feeds back and forms it at the same time. And so he's talking about this sort of transition from the verbs of doing and acting and happening to being. The sense of being, of isness, of inherent, intrinsic qualities, characteristics. The Buddha said, when this is, that comes into being. With the arising of this, that arises. And so when we talk about the self, it's this sense of being in this or trapped in this sense of being. And being as, and this is key, a static, fixed state. And having that sense within ourselves, then we sort of translate that onto everything else. So other things become trapped in their staticness, in their beingness. Things, people, situations, time, memories, futures. And so, you know, it seems little wonder that our actual experience within delusion is of a confinement, right? A confinement within a verb, or a state of being, or just to be. I am. Which is how attachment to the self is described, as being stuck in a sense, a sensed state of fixedness. And so Emperor Wu is saying, what is the highest meaning of the holy truth? And here again, truth not some in some sort of abstract philosophical sense, but what is the reality that when we encounter it directly, frees us? That's really what he's asking. when this is, as the Buddha says, something has appeared. What is the nature of that? The footnote in the koan says, each time you drink water, it hits your throat. It's direct. It's true. This is not confined. We shouldn't deny it. But nor should we follow after it. What is the highest meaning of the holy truth? How do we experience, understand, see things so that we do not struggle? Turn it around. When we are struggling, how are we experiencing things? The scholar went on to say, the Buddha put the principle of causality, cause and effect, or more precisely, causal dependence, the teaching of dependent origination. When this arises, that comes into being. That each and everything, anything, everything, nothing exists on its own. Everything exists within a state of intimate codependence, mutually arising. And he says the Buddha put this at the very center of his examination of the struggle of life and its liberation. He said this emphasis on causal investigation is both the most distinctive feature of Buddhist thought and its major contribution to the world. He said world philosophy, but I say the world. For over the centuries, Indian Buddhists successively drew out ever deeper implications of this brilliant philosophy of relations. He says, arguably anticipating many of the advances in 20th century thought. And it's really important to appreciate what he's saying there, this brilliant philosophy or reality, because it's not just a philosophy, reality of relations. You know, we think of emptiness as being sort of the quintessential state of isolation. Delusion is the quintessential state of isolation. This intimate, causal, codependent, mutually arising reality is another way of describing emptiness. Nothing is. You could say, but everything ising. And it's ising so fast that we can't see it. And so we conclude it just is. But then he goes on to say, importantly, the Buddhists, however, are interested in these characteristics insofar as they involve us experientially. That is, insofar as our dissatisfaction, our anxiety, our dis-ease either come about or with effort come to an end. It is this existential concern, this inquiry of awakening, of liberation, that distinguishes Buddhist examinations from the similar dynamic view of the world of modern science. Buddhists apply causal examination to experiential concerns. There's nothing theoretical about this going on. Otherwise, we'd be sitting in a classroom at desks taking notes. The whole point is to involve us experientially. Dada Roshi said it, used to say in training, there are no tourists. When this is, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises to be. When this is not, that does not arise. When this does not, with the cessation of this, that ceases. monastics have been studying Nagarjuna, we were looking at a passage in the text we're studying where Nagarjuna said, whatever is dependently originated, whatever arises independence on other things arising, which they themselves also appear only in a dependent relationship with other things arising, and those things only arise in dependent relationship with other things arising, a reality of relations that has no end, no limit. Whatever is dependently originated is explained, is understood, is realized to be empty. It's the same thing. That, being a dependent origination, is the middle way. There does not exist anything that is not dependently originated. Nothing just appears. Nothing stands by itself. Therefore, there does not exist anything that is not empty. What is the highest meaning? Empty. To be free of suffering, to free ourselves of suffering, step by step, day by day, is to see into how it arises. And because it arises out of these mutual relations, we have to study those relations. Mind, body, action, consequence. You speak, I react. To examine its causal dependence. What is the cause of this moment? Right? We often want to know, why is this happening? And then what? We could write a book. We could tell our story. What is arising? That's why Zazen is so essential, and that's why extended periods of Zazen. And so in a sense, every day that we're practicing, we're developing. We're developing our capacity to examine these mutual relations. And then when we practice more intensively, we're not just expanding on that or sort of intensifying that development, but we're having a more sustained opportunity to see that which arises and how it does not rise alone. What are the conditions? So we, over and over again, we hear in the teachings that everything appears because of causes, karmic actions, and conditions. So the scholar went on to say, all of this shows how things in the world, that is our common experiences, and the accumulated results of our own experiential histories, respectively, can come into being and continue to function based on nothing but their own recurrent patterns of interaction. Bereft of any fixed identity or controlling agent, guiding or directing them, either from within or without. In modern terms, they self-organize, which is a principle of a complex system. It self-organizes. And so we think, how could this be happening? How could I have gotten this far? How could I have done the things that I did if I wasn't doing it and there wasn't a me, a master controller? Right, who exists from one moment to the next and has these sort of intrinsic qualities, the me-ness, being, and that's doing all this organizing. How else could it happen? Well, when we realize that when we realize self-nature, it doesn't begin at that moment. Right. What we realize in that moment is the self-nature of this and everything that always is. And so the way we got here was based on nothing but recurring patterns of interaction. Bereft of any fixed identity or controlling agent. Self, soul, anything eternal that has a kind of guiding consciousness. Somebody earlier said that it seems as though they are nothing but a habit. I said, yeah, pretty much. The habit of these recurring patterns of interaction, which are quite sophisticated. I mean, look at what we do without this fixed identity and controlling agent. It's impressive and it's terrifying. And so when we really practice letting go, vast emptiness, nothing holy, when we really practice letting go into that, which really means, so what are we doing? We're letting go. In a sense, we're letting go of to be. But that's easy, because that's just, those are words. It's very conceptual. In the moment that we're letting go, that to be is mine. Mm-mm. It's not just mine, it's mean. It's me, mine. And I don't see it as something that's happening. I don't see it as a process. It just is. To be. A fixed identity, a controlling agent. And so to let go, you know, to let go of the little stuff, okay. But when we really begin to release, and so that sense of that controlling agent, that fixed identity, actually begins to be lost. Almost invariably in the beginning, a student, a practitioner will react with fear, with anxiety, will startle themselves back into being, into this. And so we continue until that becomes more trusted. Emperor Wu said, who are you facing me? And Bodhidharma said, don't know. He's speaking from, directly from, don't know. He's not speaking philosophically. There's only this, and there's no one who can know it. It's causeless. A student once asked the Buddha, who is it now who craves, who's craving? And the Buddha said, this is not a fit question. He went on to say, I am not saying someone craves. When I speak about craving and releasing ourselves from the grasp of grasping, he says, I'm not saying someone craves. If I were saying this, then your question would be fit. But I'm not saying this. And not saying this, if you were to ask me, conditioned now by what is craving? This is a fit question. And the fit answer is conditioned by feeling. When we come into contact and there is sensation, I want that. And so he recognizes from the very beginning the power of words, the power of language. He won't answer that question, who craves? Because to answer it, he has to enter into and affirm that assumption. And so he says, that's not a skillful question. to ask it correctly. And so, and not being a skillful question means asking it and answering on that basis is going to further strengthen that illusion. So rather, if you ask, by what is craving conditioned? What are the relations interacting? Without an agent, without a fixed identity, such that craving arises. And then he said, this body changes and alters. With the change and alteration of this body, consciousness becomes preoccupied with the change. Just ask anybody who's getting older. Agitation and a constellation of mental states born of this preoccupation with the change of body remains obsessing the mind. Because the mind is obsessed, we become frightened, distressed, anxious, and through clinging, we become agitated. When we experience the one who is going through changes and alterations. Wait a minute, this is supposed to be fixed. Like, you know, through all of those years of youth and good health when things seem to be static and reliable and available, I thought we had a deal going on here. So in letting go and not injecting a sense of I am. So that's why both, you know, letting go of the narrative is so essential, not just because it's distracting, which it is, but because actually it's informing us in every moment. It's not just sort of neutral noise. It's very potent because it's language. We are talking. We are using these nouns and verbs. We're using all of the machinery, right, that is our consciousness itself, which is creating this sense of someone who is craving, someone who is practicing, someone who wants to be free, someone who is struggling. And so when we see without judging, without labeling, without adding, that's what we're doing, is we're not adding any more sense of to be. When we don't identify with the pain, whatever form it takes, it's just sensation. And that sense of sort of de-investing ourselves, rather than making things, well, it's hard to even use the language. I was going to say making things impersonal, but that is all completely predicated on the sense of the person and having. And so what is it to experience something intimately, in direct contact, without any veil? Because the senses don't, rather, they're not being dulled, they're actually becoming back to life. All right. So what is it then to just experience contact, sensation? I imagine most, if not all of you, have experienced that. Through meditation, in session, where something comes alive. Something very simple, very ordinary. You have a different experience. It hasn't changed. It's dissolving the sense of what stands between, within, without, as being. There's an interesting story in the commentary where a master, Shiju, was transmitting to his disciple Renshan the robe and the Dharma. And Renshan said, I am not such a person. And Shiju said, because you are not such a person, you do not afflict the one who is receiving the robe. Because you are not such a person, there is no affliction. There is no nothing is arising in giving you the robe. And then he goes on to say, now that you are thus most important, don't appear in the world too readily. If you rush ahead and burst out flippantly, you'll surely get stuck en route. And this is an important principle. It's called nurturing the sacred fetus. That when someone finishes training, in the best of circumstances, they disappear for a while. They don't immediately start teaching so that they can, so they won't burst out flippantly, so they can just mature. Still and silent, he says, empty, nothing holy, the approach is far off. And by that, the footnote says, very far off, not near to human sense. That in this, there is no I am. Still and silent, sitting at Shaolin, in silence he completely brings up the true imperative. The further we go, the closer we come, the more the imperative is raised. Dharma Roshi used to speak a lot about the spiritual imperative, often in terms of the monastic impulse. But it belongs to everyone. The imperative of this life. The clear moon of autumn turns its frosty disk. If you go out after sitting, you'll see it. A just born baby moon in the frosty winter night. And you'll see the Milky Way, thin, the Dipper hanging its handle in the night. What is he pointing to with these images? The wonder. That which is always there before our eyes, that which is within us. This human life, an ongoing stream of dynamic interaction, like bursts of karmic fruition appearing as this and that. Each both a result of deep mutual relations and itself. It's just another way of saying you and I appear together. Enlightenment and delusion arise together in the same instant. Falling down and standing up arise together. Everything is here. Practice is, in a sense, just allowing ourselves to occupy this natural body of the Buddha, large, vast, unbounded. And to do that as, because of, and within this all-pervasive mutual relation. That's why when we live out of an idea of autonomy and separateness, and I can have this and it has nothing, I can own this and it has nothing to do with you, I can do this, and what it does to you is not my problem, is just wrong and from every perspective. And suffering. It creates it. It breeds it. And it affirms it. It perpetuates it. And so that's why we are in the midst of a revolution. Simple, plain, like water.
Thanks for listening. Do you have physical challenges to visiting Zen Mountain Monastery or Fire Lotus Temple? The Diamond Net is a group of Mountains and Rivers Order students who are available to support your practice. We provide Dharma and other support to Sangha members facing life challenges such as illness or mobility issues. If you would like to visit the monastery or the Zen Center but need some physical help, someone from the Diamond Net can assist you. For information, email diamondnet@mro.org or visit our webpage at zmm.org and look under the Programs menu.